Okay, my name is Molly Marin. I'm the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. I have just a few reminders before we get started today. All upcoming professional development offerings are listed on our webpage at nysrti.org. A copy of today's PowerPoint, as well as a handout with some samples, is available on our webpage. If you go under webinars and then under today's webinar title, it's under the Strand 14 section, you'll find those documents. During today's presentation, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's presentation, we'll post a link to a brief evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we appreciate the feedback. We are very pleased to have back with us Dr. Catherine Stahl to present our final webinar in both Strand 13 and 14. This is a combined, we combine the grade levels to do this final webinar. And the Strand title is Using an Assessment Audit to Create a Lean and Efficient RTI Assessment System for Grades K through 6. And our topic today is assessment garden pruning, weeding, planting, and nurturing. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Stahl. She is a clinical associate professor of literacy at New York University. She studies the effective instruction of reading in the elementary years. She is committed to improving student achievement and school effectiveness, especially in urban settings. She is currently the director of NYU Literacy Clinic. For over 25 years, Dr. Stahl taught in high-poverty public elementary and middle school classrooms. The questions that she researches stem from those experiences and from current classroom observations. Her research examines reading acquisition and reading comprehension. Dr. Stahl has written 5 books related to literacy instruction. She earned her Ed.D. in reading education from the University of Georgia in 2003. And at this time, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Stahl.
Thank you, Molly. And welcome to everyone to our last webinar in this series. And so I'm very glad to have you with us this afternoon and for being here. I see several familiar names who have been with us throughout the series and even a previous series that I did. So today we're concluding our series on the assessment audit. And, our goals have been to create a lean, efficient assessment system. And so our agenda today is to look at what happens when we bring all the information that we have compiled as a result of the audit, when we bring all that information to the table. We'll talk about how to, one of our goals is to eliminate redundancies, to think about filling any voids that are brought to the surface. Ensuring that we designate roles for each of the assessments so that we're not duplicating our processes, and then also tying our professional development into the discoveries that we have made through the audit process. So those are the topics we'll be covering, but our format today is going to be a little bit different. We will begin with an interactive discussion of our own progress framed by the audit form categories. So when we left off at our last meeting, I had encouraged you to go out to your school buildings or to the setting, whatever, you know, if you're in a district, many of you are district administrators, to go out and get this process started. And so that way, when you come back today, our purpose was to really have a conversation about some of the questions that came up as you started this process and to really have been able to put yourselves in the trenches so that you could share with me or ask some questions about how you began this process and what next steps might be for your unique settings. Because I really wanted to tailor this to a way that would be useful, most useful for you. So we will actually look at some of the, you know, I'll provide an opportunity for you to, on our chat board, communicate anything that you may have already done to begin this process in your setting, no matter how extensive or no matter what baby steps you began. The next thing we'll do is there have been 2 districts, in addition to all the wonderful examples of assessment audit forms that you see on our RTI website, I have been Very honored to be and privileged to be a part of two school districts up in the Buffalo area who undertook this process. And they have very generously shared all the information that they were compiling along the way in terms of their audit process so that you can see how two somewhat different districts approach this so that there's not just one right way to do it. And so we will actually examine some of those samples and their experience of how they, of two actual school districts engaged in this process. Then I'll summarize some key ideas, and then you'll be have the opportunity to just ask some general questions. So next, you know, as always, I really like to see who our audience is and what roles that you play in your district or in your school. So if you would actually use our polling device to display what role you play. And if you are that other, please chat in what role your other is. We have several literacy interventionists, a classroom teacher, literacy coach, special educator. And so I still can't see if our other person would chat in and tell us. AIS, okay, I would consider that an interventionist, but you're doing some of the same things. All right. And then let's go to our next slide in which you will share what grade levels you typically are involved with. Okay, very interesting. We're still missing some people, so if there's other folks. If you've just joined us, I see we have 14 participants online. So if you've just joined us, if you would go ahead and complete our poll in terms of what grade levels you are involved in. Great. Okay. So Molly, I've gone to the next slide, so thank you. So we do have a nice variety again. And as always, our resources, that most valuable resource, the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center website, which has all the audit information as well as the samples. Some of the samples that we'll be looking at today are in a folder on our RTI website. And then information about detailed descriptions of the audit process can also be found in my book, Reading Assessment in an RTI Framework. So throughout our time together, we have talked about the important purpose of the audit, that we really want to make sure that our assessment process that we engage in our schools is streamlined and systematic. We want folks that are involved in conducting assessments to communicate what they're doing and how they're doing it and how they're recording and sharing the information. We want to know, and it's really important as part of this process for people to feel valued and for us to give voice and to make transparent why people are doing what they've been invested in the past. And then also something that we want to do is to identify and really dig deeply with the information that we collect to really ask ourselves the important question, is what we're doing valid and is it reliable? Does it match what our learning constructs are that we believe in and the standards that we are teaching to? Is it reliable from classroom to classroom, from test setting to test setting? Also, how can we want to make sure that our assessments are there to serve us and not to really compromise instructional time and instructional quality, because we do recognize the consequential validity of assessments, that what we assess and how we choose to assess does indeed influence instruction. All right, so the forms that we each have used and that we have agreed upon are, and that I have shared with you, are these forms that can be found on the New York State RTI website and also in the book. And so our first step that we are going to do is we are going to sort take a look at these categories and identify, you know, that so through this form, so this is really the next slide that I really wanted us to do, because I want to find out where we are in the process. So many of you have been with us for the last two webinars, and we did say, you know, in our last webinar, please go out and try to begin this process. And so there are a couple places you might be in the process. When you went back to your schools, you may have looked at those forms and distributed them to the individual teachers and given them directions individually how to complete the audit form so that you can gain an idea of what teachers are actually doing. The next step might be that each of those individuals then met at a grade level team meeting to discuss the individual audit and to come up with a grade level sheet, a master sheet that would then be taken to a school meeting. And I see here that there was, okay, a preliminary school audit meeting has been held. Now, I'm assuming that since these middle blocks are not filled out, that preliminary school meeting was that this is something that we want to undertake, and so how will we go about doing it, and then the individual teacher's forms might have been submitted. And so it looks as though we haven't really at any of our buildings had individual grade level meetings yet to come up with a grade level summary sheet, which includes the redundancies and voids. So that's a And also, I see someone who's at the district level may have met to say, let's get together at the district and initiate this process at each of our schools to help us inform this. So that's good. So this is very helpful in helping to frame our continuing conversation. So let's go to the next slide. So now we are going to actually look at the actual when discussing either at the district level or if you disseminated this form to the grade level, as many of you said that you did, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some of the things that were exposed either at the grade level or even challenges that you, in actually being the person who may be rolling this out, may have questions. This is the part of our conversation that I'd like to have be very interactive. And so I'd really like you to provide either feedback for me and for our group in the chat box about issues that have come up or questions that you might have about each of these categories. All right. As a result of disseminating this information. So in general, use the comment box to share. What general information did you discover even when you were implementing this at the individual level or when you did your preliminary meeting? What general information did you discover about the tools that people are using? So for example, is data from mandated tools being used, not just use mindlessly because it's mandated, but are teachers comfortable using the data from those tools to inform instruction? Oh, what are the instruments that people are using behind closed doors, and why are they using them? And what are some questions that you have about this category? So I'm so happy to see people typing because I want this to be very interactive. Mm-hmm. Yes, Jill, I agree. Comprehension is harder to measure. Jill, could you fill in what tools are people using to measure comprehension at your school? Wow. Interesting, Laura. So, and Laura is saying that people, the teachers themselves, they knew they were administering certain assessments that were mandated, but the actual purpose of the assessment and different functions of the assessment were not always clear to teachers themselves. I think that alone is interesting information for administrators and literacy coaches and district people to be aware of, because who's going to buy into something if they don't really understand what the value of it really is or why they're doing it? Yes. Oh, Salvatrice, I found this, what you're describing, I found that happening in several schools. For example, I think I shared at meeting number 2 that I was working in a school that had a new administrator, and the old assessments that they were using were Dibbles assessments. The new administrator bought into Ames Webb, but some of the teachers, because they liked the Dibbles or because they had used the Dibbles before and didn't really understand the function of these assessments, they were using both, and or using obsolete tools, as you point out, that are not really rigorous enough for the new standards. And Andrea, absolutely. That we are all using STAR data, DRAs, and Founders and Pinnell kits. And I think it's very important, and especially because we're now at the end of the year, I think those of you who are attending this and are invested in assessments and do understand assessments, and even district people, I really think that one of the imperatives, and this is a little off the topic of this particular, but maybe not, that we need to take a look, and I know there are going to be a lot of changes in the tests, in the state ELA tests, but I do think that it is important to say the information that we are getting from our formative assessments, are they correlated? Let's make a table, and let's take a look at all of our kids in grades 3, 4, and 5, put down their assessment results that they got on whether it's STAR, DRA, or Founders and Pinnell, and the score that they got on the state ELA. Are these tests giving us information that is aligned and correlated with the ELA? Or are we getting false positives from that Founders and Pinnell? Here we think a kid is rolling along and he is just fine, and so we're not concerned about him. Then we give the ELA and he is he's in category 2. I think often, Joanne, what you have pointed out is I think many people just put those scores in a notebook, or just they know that they're there, but they do not even understand how to use them and to inform instruction. Or I think we have people who are at the opposite end of these tools. Let's say you're using something like Ames Webb, all right, or you're using some other form of CBM. So you get your CBM data, and you see that some children are in yellow or red, all right? And so those children just automatically are getting put into intervention settings, but then once they get into intervention, the Tier 3 teacher, or I would say even in special education, diagnostic tools are not being used that are going to be essential to pinpoint instruction for those children. Yes. Oh, Patty. You know, comprehension, and I think Jill is the first one, or I forget who was the first person up there. The comprehension assessment is just it's really challenging. I think with comprehension, we have to agree that there is not one tool that is going to serve all purposes. And so therefore, I think in the upper grades in particular, in terms of tools, we don't want to spend too much time. Something that is very, very labor intensive, that is going to do what we said in the last slide, compromise instructional time. The most important things for kids are having instructional time and having time on task. And so if we are spending 5 days, three times a year, doing these belabored assessments that are not even correlated and that are only giving us one snapshot of comprehension, that is something that we want to evaluate. And therefore, I think that actually looking at, you know, perhaps in grades 3, 4, and 5, getting a lexile that is going to help us inform, to help us get a ballpark figure for where that kid's assessment is, and then actually using some more in a classroom formative assessments that are aligned with instruction and that have some writing samples and also have the same kind of rich high-level comprehension questions that match the ELA regardless. You know, and the Common Core is not really going to go away, those anchor standards, which are high-thinking standards. So we might want to be thinking as we look at future directions, that might be a place where we might want to go. Yes. Okay, so let's go to, this is a very rich discussion. Thank you all for your participation. So let's see if there are any additional, some of your comments addressed the purposes of assessment. So so some of the things that we might talk about related to, do the existing assessments fulfill your needed purposes? So for example, is the universal screener being given a privileged position in informing decision-making about interventions? Because as I said, we certainly don't want to have too many assessments that make the picture muddy in terms of who is the neediest in terms of getting intervention. But we also have to know that the information that a universal screener provides, it's very generic, and that when kids get into Tier 3 instruction, we've got to have some diagnostics to inform what the intervention looks like. And we've got to know that if we're using an intervention screener in, say, K1 and 2 that is on foundational skills, and we have children that are having comprehension problems, we want to make sure that we're not just putting kids indiscriminately into intervention settings, that those screeners, you know, that we want to have interventions that match our data. That's the key thing, is that the intervention needs to match the data. We've got to have our interventionists, particularly, you know, in Tier 2, we may be using a standardized protocol, but in Tier 3 and special education, those children have special needs, and we've got to have diagnostic interventions so that we can target instruction and really make that intervention very intense and fine-tuned so that we can actually hit the bullseye. Tell me a little bit about the kind of diagnostic tools being used at your school. I haven't heard much about that, and whether your special ed teachers and whether your interventionists are using specialized diagnostic tools. Casey, I am sorry that I'm not really up to date on math assessments. I am really just a literacy person. I'm very sorry about that. But I wonder if we could talk about, provide some feedback with how diagnostic tools are being used in your Tier 3 setting and how your special education and those of you who are special educators use reading diagnostics to really pinpoint instruction for your children. So Erin, you're saying that special education uses Woodcock-Johnson, but that's not a diagnostic. That's a norm reference test to simply compare children to norms. It does not inform in any way, shape, or form what you need to do with a kid who's sitting in front of you. Oh, so Laura, great. So you are using the QRI provide. You know, I think if you have kids in tier three in special ed, I don't know how you get away from you. I don't think you can teach comprehension in grades 3, 4, and 5 in special education or in tier three without administering a QRI. And some of the assessments that developed Lori has developed are excellent. Now, tell me the Founis and Pinnell. I'm very curious how that might be used because there is no data on their. They have no retelling guides. They have no specific questions that are asked, and they have no technical data on the validity of their comprehension measures. So, Joanna, maybe you could elaborate for me on exactly how that's a valid measure of your comprehension in the upper grades, because I'm a little confused about that. Oh, that Words Their Way spelling inventory is indeed an evaluable. The Words Their Way spelling inventory is a valuable resource across the grade levels, I think, and particularly for targeting who are the kids. If you've got kids in 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade who need intervention, that's one good way to figure out who are the kids who have pure comprehension problems and who are the kids who probably are going to need a more targeted foundational skills as well. Now, progress monitoring tools, are they being used vigilantly in your schools? Progress monitoring, are teachers using them like twice a month for tier two, once a week for tier three, and weekly in special education? Is that happening in your school settings for progress monitoring? Oh, good. I'm glad to see the progress monitoring is happening, because I know that is hard for some schools to begin to carry on and do that. But for comprehension, Joanna, I really encourage you during this assessment audit process to dig in deeply to the technical equipment or to the technical. When we're talking about using the Founis and Pinnell for assessment for comprehension, it just doesn't have the technical characteristics that are going to be aligned with any kind of construct of high-level comprehension that we are requiring and that is desirable for our kids. And so I think that it's fine in kindergarten and first grade to use for leveling and to see what level our kids are, but for second grade and once comprehension is the focus, it just doesn't have the reliability built in, nor does it have the technical information. They have no technical information, and it has not been field tested for comprehension in any way. So, and iReady again is as fine as a screener, but well, the iReady is fine as a screener, but you're really going to have to do more diagnostic information. And Joanna, what tool has those constructs? I hate to tell you, the QRI. And so therefore, if you are in tier three in special ed and have children with comprehension problems, you've got to use the QRI. No way around it. I mean, I hate to say something that definite, but it has. The QRI is going to give you all the really information that you need, and with the field testing and the, you know, it just has so much of the technical information that you need. So it's really for tier three, you can't, but it's very detailed. You can't give that to everybody. You can't administer that to everyone. So it really has to be reserved for children who are in tier three in special ed, who you really do need to learn about their comprehension as a diagnostic. Now tell me, let's go to our next area. Let's go to the next area. Were there areas that you found? Now I saw that only 50% of you had really done the grade level test yet. And So at grade level, and I didn't see anybody saying that they had had their grade level meetings yet. So it may be premature for me to be asking whether you have discovered areas that are being over-tested or whether you discussed whether you discovered areas in which there were voids. Have you discovered areas in which the children were being over-tested and other areas in which there are voids? Yeah, you may not be far enough in your process yet to discover that. How do you feel about the frequency of your test administration? I think most of these kinds of screeners are given 3 times a year. Do any of you anticipate challenges or issues that you personally want to bring up in your assessment audit process about the frequency of particular tests? Oh, we have nothing for assessing writing. I mean, I think the best way really to assess writing is through using common formative assessments 3 times a year with grade level teams creating unit tests based on, say, their literary, science, or social studies units that they're doing, and then having children write in response to text. Based on units that they have engaged in study on, and then you're giving them a prompt similar to the kinds of prompts that you find on the ELA, and then your professional learning community, grade level team, sit there and look at those papers and, you know, might even share papers and exchange papers so that, for example, if I'm on a fourth grade team, then I'm going to score using a common rubric that we're all sitting together, say from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock, and we're going to swap papers, and we are all going to score the students' written responses based on a common rubric, and that throughout the school year there would be, you know, 1 or 2 assessments on narrative responses, informational responses, and explanatory written responses. Yeah, so, and I think that, and so some of what I'm seeing is fairly typical. Now, tell me about your training procedures and what was revealed about the training procedures. This, I think, at least in the schools that I've worked with, was a big eye opener, because many schools would do the initial training and then new employees never received training on the test, unless maybe they did year 2, but year 3, usually not. Also, even for formative tasks, let's say something like the Dulch words. Let's say we all agree, and in the primary grades, that we are going to have certain Dulch word lists that we are all accountable for. Well, we may have agreed upon that, and that may seem standardized and systemic, but when I walk into classrooms, I see those formative tasks being assessed in very different ways, because there was never an initial training on, this is what we're going to do. The child has 1 second to read the word. If it takes more than 1 second, they either don't know it or it's scored as decoding, and we're going to have this common scoring sheet and a common protocol for doing it. So in those things, even the initial training was flawed. Fidelity checks, you know, to actually walk in and have partner teachers do fidelity checks with check sheets on each other so that we can support each other. Because without fidelity checks, all people are well-intentioned. We are all well-intentioned. But I walk into classrooms and your hair would raise to see some of the kinds of narrative that is happening between teachers and children during the, say, a benchmark kit assessment test. The prompting, the lack of prompting, the variation in it is really alarming. It's really alarming. Without fidelity checks, done in an honest way and done in a professional way, many times the tests that we administer, you know, are just not very reliable. They're just not very reliable. And so we want to have fidelity checks with, you know, teachers being partnered, maybe being partnered with their literacy. In my book, I talk about how classroom teachers and whoever their interventionist, having those teachers partner up together and do fidelity checks with each other. And that also helps them be partners, but it also makes the testing process go by faster. Sometimes we can sort of drag that out over a couple of weeks, but if we know that we are in a partnership with another person, it forces us to stick to a pretty rigid schedule. And then the booster sessions, you know, I've been doing this testing for a very long time. I'm glad to see, Patty, that you really are, you know, increasing some of the fidelity checks and booster sessions. You know, I've been doing testing for 40 years, but it doesn't matter. When I have to sit down and administer that QRI, I have to sit down and reread the directions and say, now, how many seconds am I supposed to wait before I tell a child the word? Or does this count as a miscue or not count as a miscue in this particular test booklet? And so it's really important to have those booster sessions, and particularly if you're using the FNP benchmark kit and teachers are using a prosody rating for children, I would hope that you're listening to some anchor tapes of kids in the week before you're giving that FNP test, that a grade level team of first grade teachers would be listening to tapes of, say, 8 to 10 kids, rating those using the prosody scale and coming up with whether they're scoring that in the exact same reliable ways. And I think that's essential for booster sessions. And so that's something to think about as you continue to engage in this process. Okay, so now we're going to move on. And that was a wonderful discussion, everyone. Thank you so much for your interesting feedback and your experience with each of your individual school districts. Now I'm going to move on to Orchard Park School District, and you have a package of documents that you have been giving. And Mary is the professional development coordinator for K-12 in the Orchard Park School District, and she was kind enough, and the Orchard Park District was kind enough, to release these materials to us to share. And I will tell you that when I spoke with Mary, she said, now, Kay, these aren't perfect. You know, we just know that this is a living document. This is a work in progress. So don't, you know, make sure they know that this is not like our final copy. And I think that really is the big belief system, that this really is that these are never finished. It's really the audit and the revision process is always a work in progress, and it is evolving. But I think that the process that they undertook, which may not be the process you choose to undertake, can be informative to us in how to go about this at the district level. So they did decide to conduct their audit at the district level. And so you see four documents that are the outcome of this process for them that are in your package, all right? And so they have their four documents. One was the teacher review of assessments. And that's a very bulky package. And that was what each school submitted to the district, all right, that they had completed at the school level. And so that was then compiled into one district-wide, what they call the district elementary ELA audit. So this big thick package is what they received from all the schools. And so then they just put kindergarten. Here's what everybody's using in kindergarten. And they put it all together. And so this is what they received. And so let's take a look at that. They also, then the district-wide is what they came up with at the end of the process, as well as the decision trees and elementary data forms. And so these four things are in your package. So we're going to go over each of these one by one. So in October, and I'll even give you the calendar that they underwent this process. So they did a teacher review of their assessments in October. So the decision was made to do this at the district level, all right? So Mary and Lisa Krueger, who was the district curriculum leader, they decided that this was an important and timely process for their district. And so they provided the directive and the directions to the schools, all right? And so at this point, all of the schools, October through December, I think, is when the schools did their audit process. And then in December, I think by say the winter holiday, all the schools had to have their package to the district, all right, and to Lisa and Mary. And so Lisa and Mary formulated the assessment screening decision team, all right? Oh, I'm sorry. So let me back up a minute. Simultaneously, they were doing some shopping. They said, we do need to review what screener we're using. All right. And so, again, this happened at the district level. This did not happen at the school level. They said, we want to review. I think they were currently using, I forget which one they were using at that time, but they said they may have been using Dibbles, or maybe they were using Ames Web. I don't know. But they said, we want to review the major vendors and do some shopping. And we want to have all the vendors come in and give us a spiel. And then we will be critical consumers and select, based on our audit process also, select what we all agree upon is the best CBM. And so that was a team. And then they also formulated a district-wide data team. This was made up of grade level teachers, one or two per grade level, reading specialists, two or three reading specialists, two or three special education teachers, one or two speech teachers, and one or two ESL teachers, and two school psychologists. And those were gathered from all the schools in their district. So they had this group of people sitting around the table. It ended up being around 15, 18 people around the table. And they engaged in 3-day-long meetings to discuss this FAT package, the teacher the elementary one, the thickest one, the teacher review package. And so they went through grade level by grade level with teachers that were sitting around the table making comments. Here's why we use this. Different schools use different things. Different teachers use different things. And so they had a discussion. And if you look at the end of the package, you see Mary was the one on her computer was sitting and taking notes on all of this stuff. And so people would agree, you know, finally they would say during these discussions, well, yes, that really isn't that valuable. Or, oh, we didn't know that this other assessment was using it. And so the outcome of these three-day-long meetings that were held across January, February, and March, okay, so it was one day in January, one day in February, one day in March, the outcome then was the district-wide assessments for classroom teachers. It was the next thinner package that you see in front of you. And so this was where they finally, that big committee decided, okay, in kindergarten, here is exactly what we're going to be using, and they actually put them on our audit sheet. Here are the ones that we agree upon. And so, and this is when we're going to give them, and these are the boosters that we're going to be providing for them. And so they actually, what you see called the district-wide assessments for classroom teacher is really the prescription for what they all agreed upon. All right. Now, also coming out of this, this was not done in isolation, because as I said, they were simultaneously shopping for, they had three vendors come in. They had Star come in, they had AmesWeb, Dibbles, and FastBridge. All right. Those four vendors came in and tried to sell their products. And so they ended up deciding they went with FastBridge. And so that went on this district-wide sheet. They also were using this to serve as the roadmap for their RTI framework. And so then, and it was also what they used. So they decided that some of the formative assessments, they said, you know, there are formative assessments that we believe in, like, say, the Dulch test. All right. Or they decided to use Dulch words. All right. And they also, in Orchard Park, they had already undergone, they had already made some common formative assessments that were given, I think, four times a year for children to do a comprehension check. They would read a new passage on a topic that they had been studying, answer some multiple choice questions, and then do a writing prompt based on it, which was analyzed for writing process. But they wanted to clean that up. They wanted to clean up all the formative stuff that they decided to keep. And so that was what their literacy stipend work was. And that was also, they planned for the fall, for their August and fall professional development, was also all came out of, based on all of this work that they were doing. So it wasn't just an audit. It informed all of this other stuff. And so they had, oh, so there's where you see they had the FastBridge Steering Committee. So once they picked FastBridge as their test that they wanted to use for a universal screener, well, then they had to have a FastBridge Steering Committee. And so these were people who would decide what kind of training do we need for FastBridge, how do we want it, which subtests of FastBridge do we actually want to use. And this, Mary told me, we're still working on understanding, because they are now, this was their first year in FastBridge, okay? And so they just finished their first year using FastBridge. And so they are still understanding, which test did they like? Which test are they going to be used for screening? Which test will they use for other purposes? Which of those tests? And so this was the year that they got all their preliminary training in FastBridge, but now they will probably this summer sort of revisit and say, okay, now how is this going to evolve? But last summer was also when they did all of their RTI decision tree framework. So once they had what tests they were going to use, that's when they also developed their RTI decision tree, which was their flow chart for RTI, that would determine who was in tier one, who only received tier one, which children would receive tier two, and what did the intervention look like, what children would receive tier three. And so this was a very rich discussion of this process with school representatives. And so you see that you also have then two other forms. You have a flow chart, which is what they decided on would be their RTI decision tree. And so that's going to inform their IST, their data meetings, because now it's cut in stone. If you score this, this happens. If you score this, this happens. And so all that work that they did on the audit cleaned up their RTI process. And then if you look at the next form that they have, this next form I think is beautiful. I think this is a classic form. And so this now is a very It's a one-sheeter. You see a one-sheeter for grades 3 through 5, and you see on page 3 a one-sheeter for K through 2. Single sheet, here is what you test, here is when you test it. And here's, and they have something electronic that is where they put the scores for all this stuff. So this, so everything you see that started as that big fat sheet that all the teachers said they were using, we've now ended up with this little two-sheeter. It's really four sheets, but that also has their data meeting tracker. So, I mean, I think that you can really see in these four handouts the process of how it really helped them go from all kinds of assessments to a streamlined assessment system that is documented, transparent, but that also everybody buys into. I just felt like their process was beautiful. Now, there was also another school. There was also another school district. So that everything I shared with you came from Orchard Park. Also, another school district outside of Buffalo did a similar audit process. So they had, but they did it a little differently. So they started out with something very similar to the big fat pile that all the schools did, all right? So they had a teacher review forms that were discussed by similar representative teams for 2 days, all right? So they had a very same team at the district level. It happened for 2 days, all right? But then day three, they didn't have that big group. So then they had what they called a slice team. The slice team was made up of the district literacy person, the professional development district person, three literacy specialists from the district, one special ed teacher from the district, and two school psychologists from the district. So this was more of a refined team, all right? After the preliminary conversations they had the preliminary conversations with the big team at the district level, really a more district-wide slice. And some literacy specialists and special ed people with specialized knowledge. Uh-oh, my connection's lost, Molly.
Okay, you might need to just refresh.
Refresh. I don't know how to do that. Oh, you know what? I'm not having any internet connection here at my office.
Okay. Do you have the hard copy in front of you?
Oh, here I go.
Okay.
Here I go. Okay, good. I'm here, right?
Yep. Can you move the PowerPoint? I'm sorry, folks. Just bear with us.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I have something called Join Audio Conference in front of me that I can't see the slide. Do you see that, what I'm seeing?
Yeah, I don't see it. Can you get out of that window?
I don't know how to do that. All right, maybe I can just move it aside. Yeah, I can move it.
Okay.
All right, I'm just moving it someplace. Okay, so, so you see that they were a little more top-down. Molly, maybe you can move the slide for me.
I can.
Okay, because I'm not able to move my slide. Okay.
Okay, just where you want me to be, right here?
Okay, yeah, so you're perfect right there. And so what this team did then is you see how they actually made these on big charts, and they did screening assessment and scores. And so if you have, these are the screening assessments, here are the scores, that's tier one. Okay, and so they had all the screening assessments and scores that would either mandate that a child would end up either in tier two or tier three or not need any intervention. Then they had the what does the intervention protocol look like and what would be, and they did one of these charts that looked like this for every single grade level. So they had a kindergarten chart that looked like this. They had a first grade chart, a second grade chart, and all the way through to fifth grade. And of course, it was on chart paper, but it really made a very clear portrait of connections between the screening assessments, the intervention, and what kind of diagnostics and progress monitoring might be needed and how often. Okay, Molly, next slide. And so then what they did is so then they worked backward and they took those charts that were like on paper related to screening, intervention, and progress monitoring and diagnostics. Then they took them and they worked backward and they actually made a, sort of a district-wide chart that looked like where the other district started from. They made their decision tree based on that and their progress monitoring directives based on that. And their progress and their charts also included the person who was responsible for each test. And their school psychologist was excellent at creating all the electronic forms that would easily be shared by everybody. So if you could go to the next slide now, Molly. All right. But for both districts, this work that they did in the spring really informed the summer activities for both districts. That was something that was in common. So both districts also used their work. Now, this was very interesting, and I hope you'll keep this in mind as incentive for yourself and your own district. So they had started this work, and they had these audits, and they started the process. And as most districts do, they had somebody in the district office who was always receiving these proposals or RFPs from the State Department of Ed. Well, they saw that there was some grant coming out that was related to assessment informing instruction. So these two schools, they actually applied for those grants because they went, oh, wow, this is sort of like what we're doing, but we're not getting paid for it. You know, they just had to use district money or no resources. But because they had started this footwork and this process, they were able to use the work they did in the trenches on the ground to begin applying to state grants. And guess what? They got a couple very substantive grants to help fund the continued work that they were doing. And so that's another incentive. When you start doing this work, you can find agencies and such to fund it because now you have some evidence that you're really serious about it. They also cleaned up any formative assessments that they were using, and see, teachers felt honored. They felt their voices were being heard because they didn't throw out the formative assessments. They cleaned them up. And then they provided training in the new standardized testing that they were doing. That training was done at the end of August and at the beginning of the school year, and they really disseminated and trained for standardized procedures for the formative assessment. So it really was a very happy evolution. It's hard to believe that people love assessment, but I will say that there got to be a great deal of affection for assessment because people felt they bought into it and knew the function of it. Okay, next slide. And now in the 2015-2016 school year, the work continues. Booster sessions and fidelity checks for those districts were also very new. And they were able to work out kinks, and they're continuing to work out kinks that arose. So there were kinks that arose. I mean, you know, things like, you know, some of the schools, you know, with their DRA, they began using the DRA again, but they found that in first grade, children in these districts were going beyond the ceiling. But they're like, oh gosh, you know, we didn't set a ceiling. You know, we've decided though now we don't want to let just kids testing up in levels and levels and levels. We want to put a ceiling on it at a particular level and really do some more development, not just with vertical growth, but we want to look at what's happening horizontally with those kids. Or how are we reporting the screening data? So there, you know, some of the kinks are still being worked out. Next slide. But most of all, it was a changing of a mindset in how we use data. Both of these districts had previously had frequent, this was something that was interesting about those districts. they were doing tiered interventions, like they were had intervention, but they were still having these IST meetings like twice a month. And it would really, you know, the teachers would make these referrals and they'd be long, you know, they disrupted instructional time. Interventionists would have to go to these meetings and, you know, teachers would be talking about the children, no data. And so this really began to enable teachers to more comfortably use data as a major suit to trump decision-making at regular intervals, at regular data meetings. It was scary to them as caring professionals, but this was the first step along the way, and having had a voice in the process helped. But I will say, total buy-in takes time, and it takes seeing that the new way of doing things is in kids' best interest. It really does help all kids. Okay, next slide. So key points in the process, wherever you are, whatever school district does this process, key points are that voices have to be heard. We have to honor those people. No matter how outlandish or outdated their ideas appear, we want people's voices to be expressed and be part of the conversation so that we then can have them see and participate and influence the final product. We want to keep in mind that the product is a system, all right, and that the system is tied directly to instruction in specific ways, particularly those intervention tiers, and what happens in intervention. And we want roles of who's doing what to be clearly defined to eliminate duplicate testing in different settings. And PD and stipend work is directly connected and the direct outcome of this audit process. Okay, next slide. So here again, and I know this is one of the things, like, what are Tier 1 people doing? What tests are they responsible for? What tests are they? What tests are the Tier 2 teachers responsible for? And what about Tier 3 and special education? And I think this is also a time to look at the role of what we call, or what the old call was for the AIS. I think that the State Department now is sort of looking at that AIS, and that there are some much more recent white papers involved in, you know, in making that AIS role more clearly defined and it being a preliminary participant in the RTI process. Next slide. So the assessment audit is really more than just an assessment audit, as I think these two examples have demonstrated for us, because it defines what we believe about teaching and learning. It is a means of unifying, standardizing, and minimizing our assessment practice, and it has a dynamic fluidity that shapes and is shaped by our learning goals and the implementation of instruction to achieve those goals. And next slide. Okay, so that really, that last slide was really the big picture for us, is that, you know, it's dynamic, it's fluid, it's intimate related with our instruction. So general questions or additional comments. I'm not sure I'm able to see these. Molly, maybe you can, because I, you know, like my screen seems to be dead, except when you do something. So if questions come, oh, okay, good. I can see people typing questions. That's good. I was worried about that.
You can. Okay, good.
Yeah, I do see that Casey, Nicole are typing. And so I hope some other people will be typing as well.
And Nicole
Nicole, was today your first, see, this was the third. our third webinar, so it's not surprising. This was overwhelming. But I think that, you know, it's nice that we have these. Thank you, Teresa and Molly, for keeping these webinars up. I go back and refer to some of the old webinars myself. And so these are up for you to refer to, or also feel free to share these with your schools. These are a wonderful resource. And look at those sources and feel free to call on me. Oh, Casey, that's a great question. Is there a central point where districts warehouse their multiple data points for individual students? All these schools, all these districts do it. And like I said, you know, everybody either has technology people, like a lot of districts, larger districts have data teams now. And in fact, on our first few webinars, we actually had district data people participating. And so in the larger districts, they have data people. Other districts, like I know both Orchard Park, Mary and Lisa Kruger were the PD person and the literacy person were the ones who were responsible, and they did the collection of all the data. In the district number two, their PD person and also their school they have two school psychologists there that are at the district level. They were really great electronically and with data, and they assumed that responsibility. But definitely, they are warehousing it. They are definitely warehousing it. Well, I think in Tier 2, Joanna, I think a QRI is too detailed for Tier 2. I think that you might want to use... I think probably just using a Lexile is going to be your best bet for Tier 2. And also using what the classroom teacher is doing. I mean, I think that the bulk of comprehension instruction has to be happening in the classroom because it has to be embedded in a context. And so, for example, you know, whatever system your classroom teachers are using, teachers, whether they're using a Basel reader, whether you're using the modules, whether they're using a project-based approach, that there has to be an intermittent time when classroom teachers use a reading assessment in which children read a piece of text on a topic that has been studied for the last 3 weeks. Children read a new piece of text, they answer questions, and they do a writing process on it. And those intermittent assessments that are administered in standardized ways are really the best gauges of comprehension. And so we can't count on just a fly-by-night snapshot of comprehension. We have to use a constellation or what Paul Vandenbroek calls a suite of assessments. And there simply is not a silver bullet. If you are using something like a silver bullet score, you are going to find that it is not really pinpointing what you need to pinpoint for instruction. However, a Lexile is going to be more closely targeted to giving you a reading level in grades 3, 4, and 5 than something like the F&P is, because it's more precise. Because it is theoretically based on the same construct that comprehension is based on. But I do think that for Tier 3 and special education, and many, you know, and I think this is something, the training, when we look at training, I think districts often, and this is actually what these two districts also did. They actually pulled together and did some summer institutes of training for the interventionist and special education teachers who, to make sure they had a common set of diagnostic tools to use. One more comment I want to make in just the remaining minutes. And, you know, I will say that these two districts that I gave you as examples, I set in on their, the reason I am so intimately familiar with what they did is because they called me in to sit in on the meetings as a critical friend. So I would sit in their meetings, and, you know, not all of them, but I sat, like, in the Orchard Park meeting, I sat in on meeting number 1 and 2. They did the rest themselves. In the district number 2, I sat in on one meeting, one slice meeting, and I think maybe 2 of the slice meetings. I was there for the slice meetings. And so you may want to consider recruiting a critical friend, you know, a professor, maybe, like, if you're in the Buffalo area, getting somebody like, you know, that's in the reading department at Buffalo State, or, you know, getting Teresa Janczak or somebody that is local with a local university to come in and help facilitate. And not, I didn't even facilitate. I was actually there as listener, and they would say, what do you think about this, Kay? Or what are your thoughts on this? Or do you have any research on this? They facilitated because they were going to have to carry it out. I was there as a listener and as someone who might give my opinion. So that's another thing that you might want to consider as you engage in this process. Inviting one of your experts that you have come to your school to work with you to do sustained professional development in literacy to sit in on this with you and to participate with you in this process. Any other questions?
Okay, well, we wait to see if there's any more questions. I'm posting the link to the evaluation.
Oh, yes, Nicole, you can certainly contact me. I think my email contact is on the front page of the presentation. And you can certainly just Google KStahl at NYU and get my email contact as well. It is also on the front page of the presentation. And please do take a few minutes to fill in your survey. Thank you so much. It has been a delight to be with all of you for these last 3 sessions. I have really enjoyed seeing your names continuing to pop up, and your feedback today was really, it was informative to me as well. So thank you so much for joining our webinar, and hopefully I look forward to seeing you on future webinars.
Okay, Casey, I see you said the survey didn't come up. It'll come via email as well. So, and if there's any problems, you can email me, but I'm not sure what's going on with that. Kay, fabulous presentation as always. Thank you so much for joining us for these 2 strands. And if you could just hold on for a minute, I'd appreciate it. Thanks, everyone. We hope to see you on a future webinar.
Bye.